What's happening, Blair?
Not much. Doing some meal prep and enjoying a nice Friday. Gonna try to sneak a bike ride in later.
Oh yeah. Like how many, like how far do you normally go in distance? Like how long for?
Since I'm just getting back into it, over the winter it's too cold. The wind chill is awful, so I can't. If it's under like 50 degrees, I'm not gonna bike unless I feel like layering up.
What's 50 degrees Fahrenheit in Celsius?
No idea.
Let's go 50 degrees. 50 Fahrenheit. How do you spell Fahrenheit?
Just put F. Puts 50F to C and it'll tell you.
It does. 50 at 10 degrees Celsius. That's not cold, that's warm.
That's not warm.
That's how that's the temperature it
But
is
that's
in
the
the
point
UK
is
right now. I'll go
when
out with my
you
top off.
But my point is, when you bike, you add a significant amount of wind chill. It's not like standing outside in 10 degrees C. It's moving with a wind chill of, it changes that temperature down to zero very quickly. It's it makes a huge difference.
Stop
I
being
don't
soft,
it,
yeah.
you clearly don't bike. You just do pansy exercises where you stand
Pansy,
still in the
and
pansy.
I can still handle. That's harder to handle the cold, like because you're standing still.
No, the wind chill makes the difference.
Oh, I'm just
Try biking once in your life and come back to me
wear
and
more layers, yeah.
I do sometimes, but I'm just saying it's when it's 30 degrees, 0 C or lower, minus 10 degrees C, I'm not biking, and I'm not doing it when it's 50 degrees out with wind chill and just not doing it. It's got to be north of 60. It's got to be.
You cause it's because you're from Florida where the sun's always shining and it's nice and warm where you're from.
Yeah, correct.
You're too soft.
You're not hurting my feelings by saying that.
No, I'm jealous.
I'll stay indoors and lift weights all winter, but I'm not biking. So, to answer your question, I'll probably do like 12 to 15 miles, which I consider a shorter ride.
Yeah, fair enough. I've been listening to the radio this morning, and with Red Nose Day coming up soon, this one of the radio presenters is cycling 100 miles a day for 5 days, so 500 miles,
Wow.
and she's cycling from London to Manchester to a place called Hull, which I don't know why anyone would ever go Hull. Sorry if I've offended anyone there, but but like there's nothing going on over there. She's completed, today's the last day, and on the radio she's like raised over £1 million, which is very
Wow.
impressive.
What the fuck is Red Nose Day?
Oh, you don't, a Red Nose Day is like a charity event. I think it's for the Red Nose charity, right? Is that right? Let me
Don't know what that is.
Red Nose Day 2024. Oh, it's for comic relief, sorry. You heard of the comic relief charity?
Nope.
No. I'll let you do your research. We can chat about that another time.
Yeah, speaking of research, that's what we're talking about today.
Oh yeah, we're finally on the research topic. We've
We're
been
finally,
telling,
yeah, we've mentioned it 1,000
we've
times.
told everyone we'll tell you how to break down research, and it's never happened.
I think it's important. It's one of those, we had to take a whole class on research design and methodology to understand how to look at it and be analytical towards what research is trying to tell you. And so we're not going to get too deep in the weeds. This should be a shorter episode, but I think it's important for people who like what we're doing and want to try to start being able to do it on their own and not just wait for us to come up with a podcast episode to help them understand what they feel might be bullshit.
Well, truth be told, I'm going to be the student in this episode because every research article I've ever read, I've just broke it down myself. And so maybe you might tell me that I've been reading research wrong as well. So, I might be able to ask some questions that some listeners may have in this episode too.
we can look at the, like, types of research and what we mean when we say research, because I think sometimes, you know, there's always the, sometimes it's a meme, sometimes it's a joke where people say, oh, you do your own research, and they just wind up watching YouTube channels or doing a quick Google search. And
well, that happened to me once. Like, a company asked me to work with them because they told me their product, which was like this cream, improved like stem cell production. And this girl basically said she went from not being able to walk to being able to walk. And I was like, sounds a bit extreme. And I was like, can you provide me with any research which shows that like stem cells are increasing in the body based on like the products that you're providing? And she basically sent me like 5 links to YouTube channels with this guy in a lab coat basically saying, this product is research backed. And I was like, that's not research you just sent me. I was like, you basically just sent me a video. And then she was like, oh, like, she was like, I'll get back to you, and never did.
Yeah, it's it is funny. Like, I do think a lot of people think, we touched on it last episode with ice baths, where we were talking about people will trust someone that sounds confident, whether they actually know the knowledge or information or research. When we say research, we mean a designed study. So there's a hypothesis. It follows the scientific method of, this is my question or proposal. My goal is to, you know, there's several ways. So the weakest type of research is called a case study, which is basically just one or a small group of people. And there's really no, it's just observational. You're just looking at, like, this is the person, they have X disease, and we're just going to, like, kind of follow their prognosis through this condition.
Is that, like, closer to, like, anecdotal?
To a degree, yeah. It's typically more like scientific in the sense that you have a team of people monitoring and breaking down what they're observing. But I would say that the ultimate point of a case study is to notice some sort of trend or commonality or something, an anomaly, and desire to look into that.
Okay. Further. Right. So it's more like it gives you a reason to do research, basically.
Correct. Yep. Then you have correlational, which is going to be large data sets, so like NHANES or the Framingham study. Like, there's a lot of these big, massive studies where they just constantly collect data. And I think this is one of the most dangerous types of research in how it's applied and how it's looked at, in that you get statements like high intakes of red meat correlate with cancer.
Yeah, of course.
Or correlate with heart disease. And ultimately, where these studies go wrong is correlation is not causation. Anybody that remotely understands research will say that. And the intelligent media use tricky language to confuse people and not directly use the word correlation. So you might see things like red meat intake is linked to cancer.
Yep.
Or red meat intake is linked to heart disease. And it doesn't mean, literally, you could have a study say that no amount of red meat can ever lead to heart disease. And technically, those are linked because it was mentioned in the same study.
Yeah.
Like, it, there's a link there. It doesn't say what the link is.
Yeah.
So basically, how that type of research works is you go to the doctor every year and they ask you questions. You agree to be in this collection of data, and they say, how many times a week do you consume red meat? 0, 1 to 3, 3 to 5, 5 or more. And over the thousands of people that they've collected this data across their lifetime, they find that the people who have consumed red meat 5 or more times a week have the highest incidences of heart disease.
Sure.
And they try to control and, like, take out certain elements like smoking and exercise if they can. But ultimately, it starts to, that you know, oh, controlled for smoking, controlled for sedentary lifestyle, you still have this incidence occurring. But the problem is, like, what does red meat mean? You know, on average, someone who eats red meat 5 or more times a week is going to consume a lot of fast food. They're unlikely to be someone who is consuming grass-fed, lean ground beef that they're cooking at home.
Well, when you think of red meat, you think of burgers mostly, rather than, you know, like minced meat from a taco or something, you know what I mean? Like
that. Correct. Like, yep. Or big fatty steaks. You exactly. Know, I mean, and so it's like, and red meat is expensive. Beef is expensive. So you're unlikely to have someone who is buying filet at, you know, $20 to $30 a pound and consuming that on a nightly basis versus someone who is buying a burger from McDonald's for $2.
Right. And then you have to start looking at, like, if you're buying a burger from McDonald's, what does that person's other habits look like?
Yeah. So it raises more questions than answers to me. Like, it's once again, I think correlational is a trigger to look further. Some of the problems we run into there is, you know, ethics. Is it ethical to force feed people red meat, knowing that there is a correlation between high red meat consumption and heart disease? So, because sure. If that information is true and you say, well, this group is going to eat red meat every day and this group is not, and it does cause heart disease, you effectively just gave X number of people heart disease because of forcing them to eat red meat for whatever amount of time.
Exactly. So you can't, like, ethically test that on someone.
Right. And so that's the next level of research, or the highest level of research, which is experimental research. And essentially, that can be broken down into a couple types as well. The most, like, potent and common is what's called a randomized controlled trial. So essentially, this is the question at hand. We'll use the unethical research that we just hypothetically proposed. Does red meat cause cancer? So my goal is to say that red meat does or doesn't cause cancer. My hypothesis is that, no, I don't think it does. Red meat does not cause cancer. So I'm going to design a study that says these people are going to be separated into two groups, what's called the experimental group, or the group that's going to eat red meat, and the control group, the group that's going to eat a very similar nutrient and calorie matched diet other than the absence of red meat. Those two groups they're randomly distributed. You don't know that you get red meat, you don't get red meat. And so over 12, you know, 16, 20 weeks, however long the design of the study is, experimental group eats red meat, control group does not, and we take measurements, you know, body fat percentage, blood markers, cholesterol levels, etc. And at the end of it, we compare.
No one's going to get cancer in 20 weeks, though, are they? So,
right, you know, so it's not a perfect example, but it's just kind of showing how randomized controlled trials.
But that's how they work, though. They are usually 20 weeks, and then people will make bold claims and statements like that.
Yeah, 16 weeks, 20 weeks is pretty common, you know. So yeah, it's one of those. The longitudinal studies, the correlational studies, I believe the Framingham study has been going on for like 75 years. But that's a data collection and analysis. It's not a experimental study. It's a correlational study. They have just been collecting what's called anthropometric data on people in Framingham, Massachusetts for decades.
Sure. So like, let's say every person who ever got cancer, they just made them fill in a questionnaire and 80% of the people tick yes to eating red meat, and that's how they got their answer.
Right. More so, they've been collecting this data, and then they see how many people get cancer, and they filter for cancer, and then they make these correlations where, of the people who got cancer, 80% consumed red meat 5 or more times a week.
Sure.
But like we already mentioned, what questions does that raise versus...
Right.
What questions does it answer?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
So. You know, so we've already highlighted one big challenge to research and understanding research is the language that's used. Link to, correlational, etc. is not a guaranteed cause and effect. It is an interesting tidbit that should ask us, you know, to look deeper.
Right, but on social media, a lot of people use, like, researcher statement facts these days.
Correct, yep. And so, you know, I think better examples of experimental research is, like, supplement research. So, does this supplement improve strength gains? Does caffeine improve strength gains? Something like that.
Okay.
You know, so, and this is where you can get into what are called placebo-controlled studies, double-blind, placebo-controlled. And so what that means is the experimental group would be taking the caffeine, and the control group would be drinking something that tastes exactly similar to the pre-workout, the caffeine, but it doesn't contain caffeine.
Like decaf or something.
Decaf coffee, or it's just a flavored drink with, you know, something else, carbohydrates right. in it. Or, you know, ideally you don't want to have any nutrients in it, like amino acids or carbohydrates even, because those could elicit an effect. Sure. So it should just be like artificially sweetened water.
But
or
you're
something
making
like that.
Them yeah. think they're drinking caffeine.
Yes. And so if the the experimental groups don't know what they're drinking, that's called a blind study. If the researcher also doesn't know which one is being given to which person, that's a double blind study. So essentially, somebody else makes up solution A and solution B and gives it to the research administrator and doesn't tell them which is which. They just write down, did they take A or did they take B? And so at the end of the study, it gets revealed to everyone that A had caffeine and B did not, or vice versa. And so a double blind is that the researcher can't have any level of indication as to which one is, because they might have a preconceived notion. They want caffeine to help with strength gains.
Sure, exactly. So they're looking for
more. And so they might encourage A group, because A is taking caffeine, to lift harder. Yeah. And they might put, you know. But if they don't know either, it removes. So the more you can remove human bias from the research, the more accurate it gets. So
basically, the less they know.
Double-blind, placebo-controlled studies are like the gold standard for, does this thing work?
And how often do you find that studies are double-blind versus just blind?
So a lot of times it depends on what the, like, what you're researching. So, like, going back to the red meat cancer example, like, you can't really blind for red meat consumption. Like, that group's going to know they're eating beef.
Sure.
The researcher's going to know, you know, so you can't double blind that. And so in that case, you would do what's called a crossover design. You know, group A would eat beef for 12 weeks. Group B would not. You would wash out, and then you would switch group B. And so you would, to make sure everyone was part of both groups and you're not just, you know, randomly putting people in one group or another. Did group A worsen while eating red meat and group B got better while not? And when you switched them, did the same thing, you know? So, like, there's multiple different ways to study to ensure that you are collecting as much information and removing as many variables as possible.
Yeah, of course. I get you.
You know, so, and then ultimately, the design of the study matters. There's a lot of things we're about to dive into, a little bit of the weeds as far as, like, how do you break this stuff down? So just kind of gave you an overview of what the different types of studies out there. So right away you look for, is this correlational? Is it just massive amounts of data and they're saying, you know, red meat consumption correlates with X disease? Or is it experimental? There's a group, a control, there's an experiment we're looking at, you know, green tea extract and fat loss, you know, so are they able to blind people and, you know, one group takes the supplement, the other takes the placebo, and they research the elicited effects. So right away, that helps you understand, like, are we actually cause and effect or are we correlation? So I think that's square one with understanding research.
Yep.
So when we look at, you know, we'll kind of ignore correlational stuff because while it, like, it's interesting, it's, I think it's, as I've stated multiple times, it's more for researchers to understand what else to research and dive into.
So it's versus important that basically our listeners know if anyone talks about correlational studies, they should take them all with a pinch of salt.
Right. Yep. Because there's funny examples out there. I don't remember them exactly, but it was like something like, you know, piracy of media files and global warming have a very strong correlation. And it's like to like a 99th percent accuracy. And it's like, that doesn't mean that downloading movies illegally causes global warming. It just means that there's a correlation somehow. They seem to be, you know, and it's like some dumb stuff out there like that where people, to prove the point that correlation is not causation. Right. It's just an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
So when you look at experimental research, there's also levels to that. And I don't mean like the placebo and double blinded and that kind of stuff, but you have types. You have what are called in vitro studies, which is basically when they are doing this stuff at a cellular level. They're taking like a human cell and they're putting it in a little vial and they're adding this extract from this and they're mixing it and they're seeing what happens to that cell. These are kind of interesting because it does let us know like, oh, blueberries are, you know, immunoprotective, or this compound from strawberries helps kill cancer cells or whatever. You know, the problem there is it takes out physiological aspects from how the human body works. A good classic example is curcumin, or the active ingredient in turmeric, being an anti-inflammatory. In vitro, it was a very powerful anti-inflammatory, but the liver filters curcumin out through digestion very effectively. So if you're not taking it the right way or in the right mix or the right strength, none of that is getting into the blood to become an anti-inflammatory because it's being filtered out by the human body.
Yeah, sure. So just because it mixes with a cell doesn't mean that your body's going to absorb it for it to get to your cell.
Correct. 100%. Then there's rodent studies. And these are they're awesome and the worst at the same time. And what I mean by that is the rodent studies, I think, are sometimes the most oversighted studies for something having a benefit. We even talked about that briefly in the Ice Pods episode, because they said that, you know, cold immersion causes an increase in brown fat tissue, which is metabolically active, but it only occurred in rodents. And the most simple explanation for why this isn't applicable is because we're not rodents.
We're not on the all most fours. Classic case of this. Our stomach isn't the same size. We're not the same size right. as them.
The most classic example of this was the old, and now it's made a comeback because of this, the artificial sweetener saccharin, which is Sweet and Low, I think, the pink stuff.
Yeah.
Equal? I don't remember. But so in the, you know, 80s, I believe, they did a research where it showed that saccharin caused cancer in rats. And everyone freaked out because saccharin causes cancer. And the problems there were, number one, they were feeding these rodents like their body weight in saccharin every day. And then number two, they actually discovered much later that the rodents had a higher nitrogen content in their system, in their urea, because of just that's how they are. They're physiologically different than humans. And that's actually what the saccharin was acting on to cause the cancer. And so they had to come back and remove the disclaimer saying that it causes cancer, because it was only causing cancer in these rodents that were force-fed egregious amounts of saccharin.
Sure.
To elicit that response.
So it was the insane amount of it.
Right. And ultimately, the take-home is rodent studies are more often than not, they are designed to basically state or figure out if it's safe to move on to human trials.
Sure.
In many instances, these rodents are specifically bred to develop diseases. They'll be like cancer-positive rats. And if you throw the book at these rodents and they don't develop cancer, you can kind of safely say like, all right, we can probably give this to humans safely without any issues, you know? And so that's a lot of times what it's, I mean, it's a way to test stuff without affecting the ethical, you know, can you give this to humans if it does cause a negative effect?
Sure.
And sometimes stuff never leaves rodent studies because it just doesn't ever seem safe or effective to move to human trials because, you know, the rats are gaining extra ears and dying or whatever kind of crazy shit goes on. You know, so if it is a rodent study, take it with a grain of salt.
And I think a lot of people look at rodent studies and then, again, use them as facts going, this is why you shouldn't consume this or that, because they're saying, look at what happened to the rat, and they're like, this could happen to you, and it's like, we're not rats.
Right. And sometimes people just quote it without saying it's a rodent study. So then, like, finally, just getting into the brass tacks, it's not a rodent study, it's not a correlational study, we're looking at a legitimate study. What we want to look at, and Adam and I have pulled up a study together that is a... it was a pretty novel study from a couple years ago, 2014, which sounds...
Just to put it out there, if anyone wants to look at the study that we're looking at, it will be in the description of this podcast episode.
Correct. I will put a link to it. The name of it is The Effects of Consuming a High-Protein Diet on Body Composition in Resistance-Trained Individuals.
Cool.
So, essentially... there's a couple things you want to look at once you've, it's a human study, it's a experimental study. The way I know that is because when I start to look, it says under the methods, you know, 30 healthy resistance trained individuals, subjects were randomly assigned to one of the following groups. So I know it's humans. I know what population, healthy resistance trained individuals, and they were randomly assigned to one of the groups, control or high protein. So HP, high protein, is the experimental group, and control is the normal protein group. So already, this is in the abstract. I'm not even actually reading the full study. So most quality studies will have a section in the beginning called the abstract. And that's where they take the most important information and condense it.
Yeah. So like a summary, I guess.
Exactly. And there are some people who will read the abstract and they'll just jump straight to the results and say, like, oh, this is what happened.
That happens too often, actually. Like,
way too often.
All the time.
We used to call them abstract scientists, you know. Yeah. So, but yeah, so it is a good way to gain the information you want quickly, but beware because it doesn't tell you everything.
It's like reading the back of a book and going, oh, I know what the book's about. I don't need to read it anymore. And people all the time do that.
Right. And if you really just need to do well in a test, yeah, read the Sparks notes and take your test. But don't pretend like you know the book in detail. So, you know, the kind of things that we want to look at to understand, like, what information we're looking to gain from this is the population. So it's 30 healthy resistance trained individuals. That means that applies to me. I'm relatively healthy and do resistance training. 30 is a pretty good sample size, so that's the number of people. I think sometimes people get confused about what's a good population. The level of drop-off in experimental trials is huge. So yeah, having 30 people fully complete this trial is awesome.
Yeah.
When you look at the correlational studies, there'll be thousands of individuals, and that's because they're not actually doing anything. They're just answering questionnaires to the doctor.
Right.
And so then the results, you know, what the high protein group consumes significantly more protein and calories pre versus post. And so you'll see these little numbers pop up. And Adam, follow me in the results. You see what I'm talking about. We're still in the abstract.
Yeah.
It says the high protein group consumed significantly more protein and calories pre versus post. And it says P is less than 0.05. So the p-value is can and often is very, very important. And what it translates to is statistical significance. And I think this is an area of research that people get confused by and don't fully understand, which is, does the what we're attempting to assess, is it... are we confident that that was actually measured, essentially? So a p-value is a statement of confidence, essentially.
Okay.
So if it's less than 0.05, that means 5%, right? 0.05 is 5%. Yep. So we are 95%+ positive that they consumed more calories than the control group or pre versus post. Whatever right. the statement is, the p-value is saying how confident, 95%. So if we looked at, right, if we looked at, does green tea cause fat loss? And the answer was yes. It's statistically significantly. So they'll say it significantly caused fat loss. There's a significant improvement in fat loss compared to the placebo, confidence value of less than 5%. You know, so we're 95% certain that green tea caused fat loss.
So the closer that number is to one means the less like confidence they have that they are sure that that's actually what happened.
Correct. And typically a statistical significance is considered less than 0.05. So 5% or less is the value you want. 95% confidence or more is considered statistically significant.
Cool.
Why am I talking about this? Why does this matter? Because statistical significance is not a measure of what we call the magnitude of effect. And I think this is where people get confused sometimes, is if I said green tea significantly causes fat loss, people translate that in their mind to say it caused significant fat loss.
Right.
But that's not what it's saying. It's saying the statistical accuracy that green tea caused the effect measured was there.
Okay.
So the in this case, you know, what was the effect? The effect was that they consume more calories than protein. We're very confident that happened, and the data supports it. So when we look at something like, I've brought green tea up multiple times because I read a study in high or in college that said green tea caused weight loss. And it was statistically significant, meaning the p-value is there. But when you looked at the magnitude of effect or how much weight was lost, it was 0.6 kilograms. So about a pound.
Okay.
Over 12 weeks of taking high dose green tea, about a pound, you know, a little more than a pound was lost. So statistically significant. We were confident that the green tea caused that 1 pound of weight loss. But 1 pound over 12 weeks is not a high magnitude of effect. Would you take a pill for 12 weeks to lose 1 pound?
Well, I guess a lot of people would.
But no, somebody took that research and said green tea causes weight loss, significant yeah, sure. weight loss.
And
but
so that's not, why a lot of people believe it.
Right. It's statistically significant, but the magnitude of effect is not there.
Right.
You know, and so that's...
Also, they can't guarantee it was the green tea, but that's just what they were measuring.
No, they can guarantee it was the green tea. That was the p-value. 95% confident that the green tea caused the weight loss.
Okay.
What they'd left out was how much weight was lost, which was about a pound.
Right.
You know, so that's where it gets, technically, they were not wrong. It was significant statistically.
Right.
But it was not a significant magnitude amount. Effect.
Right. Okay. Right. And so now everyone, like, I remember the trend where everyone started drinking green tea, like, oh my God, I'm going to lose loads of body fat.
Well, and to just highlight another issue, it was a green tea pill extract, not drinking green tea, that caused it. So, like, drinking green tea is even weaker. I think the amount would be, like, 2 gallons of green tea daily compared to this pill. So, you know, green tea causes fat loss. If you just casually drink green tea, you're not getting even close to that magnitude of effect or confidence interval. You're just drinking green tea because the head, and this is what where we get the trickle down science of green tea causes fat loss. And really, yes, it was statistically significant, but you only lost 1 pound over 12 weeks, even though we were confident that green tea resulted in this weight loss because right. we controlled for everything else. So to finish up this protein study, essentially, you know, it's got a high p-value. We know that the group consumed more protein and calories than the control group. It looks like there was about 800 more calories consumed. So we pulled up the dietary intake table, and you see that they ate about 2,800 calories compared to 2,052. So it was about 750 to 800 calories more in the high protein group.
Higher protein,
but also higher calorie.
Sure.
And so ultimately what this study found, the conclusions and the ultimate results, that there were no significant changes, meaning there might have been differences, but they weren't statistically significant, meaning they were close enough in, you know, how much things changed that they couldn't really say it mattered. So there were no significant changes over time or between groups for body weight, fat mass, fat-free mass, or percent body fat. So to me, initially, that sounds like nothing happened, right?
Yep.
But what I'm hearing is this group ate 800 additional calories, all from protein, and had similar effects on their body composition and weight. They didn't gain any extra weight from eating 800 extra calories. Their body fat didn't increase from eating extra calories. Their muscle mass did not increase more or decline more from eating extra calories.
So basically, if those people had the same calories, but the protein was higher in those calories, they probably would have lost body fat.
Maybe. Or maybe there's a point where, while protein does not want to store as body fat because of its effects in the body for muscle growth and hormone synthesis and stuff, it also, you've already reached a threshold where it's extra protein doesn't mean extra gains.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of neat that maybe some of the increase in calories is offset by the thermic effect of protein. But, you know, so yeah, if you overeat a lot of protein, and you may not gain weight or fat, but you're also not going to gain extra muscle.
Which is kind of good because it means that people can consume more food knowing they're not gaining any extra weight.
Yeah. And this study did kind of throw a wrench in the spokes of it's all calories in, calories out. Not massively so, because ultimately they did gain weight. Both groups did. 0.8 kilograms versus 1.7 kilograms. So the high protein group gained an additional kilogram.
But that's because they were higher calories.
A kilogram is 2 pounds, but really ultimately over 12 weeks, gaining an additional 2 pounds is not insane.
And actually looking at the study, like, it also, they tell you how many calories they were consuming prior to the control versus after, right?
To wrap it up, no change is not no information. You know, the absence of effect is not the absence of information. So in this case, eating more protein did not cause any significant increases in muscle mass or weight or blah, blah, blah. We can still take information from that. So Things don't have to be sensational to say there was something no change.
Happened. Yeah,
you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
There was no information to be gained. So taking, are we confident in what happened? Was there a large magnitude of effect? Like, what can we discern from this? Was it a good study? So ultimately, hierarchy of studies, you want to, for information that you're going to confidently tell other people, you want to go with experimental studies, not correlational. If you're talking about effect in human beings, you don't want to pull from rodent or in vitro studies. Those are meant for researchers to move to the next level. You want to pull from human studies with a decent population or sample and an applicable population. I don't need to look at kidney disease populations for things that I'm trying to do in my life because I don't have kidney disease. You know, so does this apply to you? Does this apply to what you're trying to figure out? And is the information you're obtaining valuable? Meaning, is there a good p-value? Is there a high magnitude of effect? Like, what, you know, how do you break it down? So like I said, I don't expect you to be an expert in research after listening to this episode. I just kind of want people to understand how research works, how to look at it a little bit more analytically, and, you know, maybe get into the nitty-gritty a little bit to make sure they're citing good information and not re-quoting rodent studies.
Well, I think it's good because next time someone does read a research study, maybe they'll listen to this podcast alongside looking at their next research study. And so, you know, it should give someone a better breakdown of what they're looking at. And, you know, they can always reach out to us if they you know, want to tell us what they think they find, and we're happy to discuss it too.
Sure. So, yeah, I thought this was going to be a short one, but it went on longer than I expected.
Well,
so.
I think it was a good length of time because, like, I think everything that was said needed to be said, because I think a lot of things there people don't realize about research studies, which is why there's so much misinformation out there, because researchers don't look at how humans absorb the information or how they'll, like, you know, or how someone will react to something they hear. You know, they're just like, oh, well, this was interesting, I want to go study more about this. They're not saying something happened, something didn't happen. They're like, I want to go learn more. Whereas people will read the research and go, oh my God, this happened, everyone should stop eating this or stop doing this. And like, they've come, like, I remember on when we were on Clubhouse and we had, what was he called? Was it Eddie Hall or something? We had a researcher come in who did a research study around no carbs versus low fats, and I can't remember, but it basically proved that keto wasn't more beneficial than another research study, and like another researcher started arguing with him, saying like your research study was completely invalid because of X markers and Y markers, and like they had a full-on argument, and like he was like, well, you oversaw the whole, you know, research document, but they were so ingrained in the like nitty gritty, they actually didn't care about the people in the audience who were listening going, oh my God, keto's not effective, or it is effective, or this proves my point, this doesn't prove my point. They were so like in like just taken in by, they just wanted to prove that like science says this and science says that, nothing to do with how someone will absorb what they're saying.
Right. And realize that 90% of research that you're going to get your hands on, maybe not 90%, but a large portion of it, is written by students, graduate and doctoral students, who are ultimately taking this research in front of a group of scientists that work in the, you know, university above them to defend their ability to graduate. So yeah. It's written to sound very intelligent and prove that they know what the fuck they're talking about. And you bring up a good point that's, I think, a good final sign-off message, which is research is about the collection of information that's out there, not what one study has to say.
Yeah.
So it needs to be repeatable. And they have types of research called meta-analysis, which is where people will go and scour meta-analysis on creatine and recovery. And so they'll find all these studies on creatine, and they'll say, we found 45 studies, and across the board, they all agree that X happens. So now it's not just what this one study said, but how do all these studies agree on this topic? And so confirmation bias, if people want keto to be good, they will blaze through and ignore any research saying that keto is no better than a low-fat diet to find the ones that say keto is great. And so that's the final sign-off, is like, try to remove confirmation bias. Don't go into it with the idea that you want this information to be correct, but maybe approach it from the opposite direction. You want this information to be wrong. If you think vegan is the shit, go try to find research that says veganism sucks. And if you can't find it and all the research says that veganism is great, maybe you're onto something. You know, but I think like having that analytical approach of like finding one study that proves your point is not science, it's confirmation bias.
Yeah, I used to do that when my early stages of fitness and education. Like if I came across something where something said X was true, I'd say, let me see if I can go find if there's something to prove the opposite. And usually I could find something that proved the opposite, and it made me realize the truth was probably somewhere in the middle of what that both the two were saying.
Yeah, good episode. So a little longer than normal, but hey, like you said, we've talked about it and built it up enough that I think people needed it.
It needed to
be. they wanted a good episode on this, because we mentioned it on every episode we've ever done.
Well, it's done now. Right, guys, we'll see you soon.
Take it easy.
A healthy debate is sugar positive and likely contains gluten and peanuts. This episode was produced by Blair Solberger. Adam doesn't help with editing in any way, shape, or form. Please remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Instagram at A Healthy Debate or email us at ahealthydebatepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.